The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h. Org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Senators Kirsten Gillibrand and Claire McCaskill have joined the call for comedian Bill Cosby to return his Presidential Medal of Freedom or have it revoked. Court documents unsealed last week reveal Cosby testifying that he'd given women sedatives with the intent of having sex with them. Still, Whoopi Goldberg, Chuck D, and others defend Cosby, and the Smithsonian Museum stands by its decision to continue showing Cosby's private art collection at the National Mall. Those works, along with Fat Albert, The Cosby Show, just about every Cosby creation, have become radioactive in light of accusations of rape and assault by nearly 50 women. And yet, only one of those alleged assaults can still be prosecuted. That's due to statute of limitation laws that prevent older cases from going to trial. David Ruoff is a trial attorney with Howard and Ruoff in Manchester, New Hampshire, and president-elect of the New Hampshire Bar Association. We asked him here to explain the statute of limitation laws in general and to better understand the sexual assault and defamation cases now against Cosby. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Virginia.
So first of all, are statutes of limitation, is that a federal laws or are these state by state?
They're both, and they vary state by state significantly for criminal or civil cases and also in federal court as well.
Okay, so criminal cases cannot be brought against Bill Cosby, if I understand that, except for by one woman because of statutes of limitations.
For the most part, that's correct. It's very difficult to bring old charges. There have to be very unique exceptions to the statute of limitations, like New Hampshire has several that would apply to the Cosby case. But in the jurisdiction where he's been reviewed, they've already concluded that they could not because there's no exception to the statute of limitations for those crimes.
So what is the purpose of the statute of limitation laws in general?
Well, the statutes of limitations came about historically to prevent stale prosecutions. It's an old throwback to old England, where the king could file criminal charges against anybody at any given time, particularly if they became politically prominent or powerful. The court would impose indictments on them and take them out of the running to become politically powerful.
Uh-huh.
So that's why you have these statutes that were passed, like the statutes of frauds and statutes of limitations, to rein in the power of the king to knock out competition. So that's where they come from. Today, they're really just jurisdictional in nature, which means that they limit when police can file charges.
With the idea being that, you know, if a crime is so old, they cannot necessarily get the evidence or they can't necessarily defend themselves?
It's more prophylactic than that. It's actually rooted in due process for the accused because it's very difficult to defend against allegations that are very, very old, very difficult to come up with alibi witnesses or rebuild timelines to defend against a case.
Well, are statutes of limitation different depending on the crime? Say, is it different for theft than something like sexual assault?
Under New Hampshire law, the statute for like sexual assault or what we call felonious sexual assault, aggravated felonious sexual assault, there's a special rule for those types of cases that extends the statute of limitations for minor victims. Okay, so if you're under the age of 18 years old and you've been victimized, your statute of limitations for reporting and having that case prosecuted doesn't run until 22 years past your 18th birthday. So it gives people the ability to get out of a household or a relationship and gives them a sufficient amount of time to be able to deal with and go forward with a prosecution and assist. For garden variety offenses, it depends on the severity. For example, for misdemeanors, it's only a year. For violations, it's 90 days. So if you get stopped for speeding and they don't give you a ticket for 90 days, you are scot-free. But for most felonies, it's typically 6 years.
How about something like murder? We have the New Hampshire cold case unit now. How far back can they go?
Murder is one of the only crimes for which there is no statute of limitations.
Now, you have a lot of experience dealing with sexual assault cases that have passed or exceeded statutes of limitation. So what is it about those crimes specifically that might make this more than a common occurrence?
Well, the dynamics in those cases, specifically cases involving children that are victims of sexual violence, the dynamics between the offender and the victim are complex. And sometimes the victim doesn't even know that they're being victimized until they are pretty far removed from that relationship. All you have to do is look at the clergy cases, mm-hmm. where many kids were thought that, you know, what was being done to them was appropriate and normal. And it wasn't only until decades passed where they realized that it wasn't. Okay. So those types of cases have really created this exception to the what was historically just a 6-year statute of limitations. Mm. And we're not going back too far. I mean, New Hampshire statute of limitations only changed in 1981. Prior to that, it was, you know, just a typical 5-year statute of limitations.
I actually just read that Florida recently doubled its statute of limitations for sexual assault cases. So is there a similar push to expand in other states?
I think as a result of the publicity of these cases, yes. That being said, you know, very old cases are very difficult to prosecute. Having done that a bunch in my career, I can tell you that when you look at a case that's very, very old, the chances of being able to put together proof beyond a reasonable doubt is pretty difficult.
I'm speaking with David Roth. He's a trial lawyer and president-elect of the New Hampshire Bar Association. And we're speaking about statute of limitation laws, especially as they relate to the dozens of alleged sexual assaults committed by the comedian Bill Cosby, only one of which may go to trial. So if statutes of limitation have passed for a criminal case, do victims have any kind of recourse in civil court?
Yes, they do. And quite often, the civil statutes of limitations for those types of offenses are longer. For example, we'll use New Hampshire as an example. It's 22 years after a victim turns 18 years old. But that is for regardless of the victim's age. Okay, that exception for the criminal statute only applies to minor victims. So you have to be under 18 at the time for that 22-year extension to apply. For a civil case, that's not true. It can be any time for the 22 years after you turn 18.
So why is that for a civil case so much easier to establish a case?
Well, I think the reason that the civil statutes are longer is because the legislatures are less concerned about criminal due process violations in stale criminal prosecutions. Keep in mind that the convictions for these types of offenses carry very hefty sentences, typically measured in decades. So I think the legislatures were more inclined to give leeway to people to sue civilly for damages. And yeah, a lot of times that's what victims want. They want reparation. A lot of times they don't want the drawn out procedure that entails a criminal trial.
Well, given that the time has passed for filing criminal charges against Cosby for sexual assault, three of the Cosby's alleged victims have filed defamation cases against the former TV star. Now, what is their argument?
They are clever. What they did was they made public their accusations, and then they allowed Cosby and his camp to deny the allegations publicly. And they're claiming that by him denying it, that they are now defamed because he's publicly called them liars. And as private citizens, the protection of defamation law from state to state is much greater. Okay, so they can actually sustain a civil action against him for him publicly calling them liars.
So have you seen that kind of workaround being used before?
I think it's rare. I haven't seen it highlighted to the degree that it's been highlighted in the media with the Cosby case, Sue.
Do you think now that all these allegations against Cosby have a strong public momentum, especially after these documents were unsealed, will prosecutors be actively looking to pursue a criminal case?
Against him? If they have a way to get around a statute of limitations bar, they will. I mean, there are routinely cases. For example, in New Hampshire, the statute of limitations stops running if you are continuously absent from the jurisdiction. So if you commit an assault in New Hampshire and you leave and go to Massachusetts for 20 or 30 years, that statute of limitations doesn't run. I don't know if New Jersey or Massachusetts have those similar types of exceptions, but I know that prosecutors tend to like to make their judgments about going forward on a case on the merits and not just because of a technical jurisdictional limit by the statute.
Well, David Ruoff, thank you very much for explaining for us today.
Glad I could help.
David Ruoff, he's a trial attorney with Howard & Ruoff in Manchester, New Hampshire, and now president-elect of the New Hampshire Bar Association. You'll find more on the statute of limitations and the Cosby case at wordofmouthradio.org. In a court of law, juries are often asked to determine whether a defendant is guilty of criminal intent or if some contributing factor compelled him or her to commit the crime. Understandably, lawyers have made all sorts of arguments as to why a defendant should not be held responsible. Think the Twinkie defense. That's a derisive term used during coverage of the trial of the man accused of killing San Francisco's mayor and the city supervisor, Harvey Milk. In this episode of the podcast Criminal, host Phoebe Judge takes a look back at the first use of the PMS defense.
She kept saying three things. I didn't mean to hurt my child. I don't remember what happened. I just got my period.
About 30 years ago, something started happening in courtrooms that caught the world by surprise. Lawyers began to attribute criminal behavior to PMS, or premenstrual syndrome. The first time was in England. A woman named Sandy Smith was found guilty of murdering her coworker, but her lawyer argued she was suffering from PMS, and the judge gave her probation for murder. Then shortly after, the PMS defense was tried out in the U.S. in a case that pit scientists against feminists against lawyers.
Serious topic here, folks. She beat her kids and she blames her PMS. Should PMS be used as a legal defense? We'll find out. Take a break. Stay with us.
Shirley was on the bed, passed out or in a state of semi-unconsciousness. The child came in after specifically being told not to come in the room because Shirley was sick and couldn't take care of her kids, that they had to stay in the other room. She came in and she jumped on her. And she reacted in a reflexive way. She said that the daughter said to her, "Mommy, you hit me."
Shirley Santos was 24 years old in 1981, a single mother with six kids in Brooklyn. This is her lawyer, Stephanie Benson.
She herself called the police. And not only did she call the police, she didn't have a phone. She had to go to a neighbor to whom she said, "Look, I just got my period, and I think I might have hurt my child."
But if we're saying that PMS at this point in the early 80s wasn't in the lexicon, why did she know to attribute something to that?
She didn't say PMS. She never said PMS. This is what she knew happened to her at this time of the month. And maybe it doesn't take a PhD for a woman to know why she feels crappy.
A few hours later, Santos was arrested. Court documents show that her four-year-old child had bruises and welts. Her kids were taken away. In 1981, lawyer Stephanie Benson was also 24 years old, working for legal aid. She was assigned to Shirley Santos.
Had you done any research or reading or anything on PMS as a legal defense, maybe as it related to the British cases beforehand, or was this something that just came to you out of the blue?
It came to me out of the blue.
This is Benson on McNeil Lair that year. Based on what she found, Benson felt she could correlate Santos's behavior with what doctors were learning about PMS. There were cases of women whose symptoms were so severe they felt capable of hurting themselves or others. She filed a motion to dismiss the case, outlining for the court all of the ways in which her client was, quote, a victim of PMS. Today we're used to women saying, "I have PMS." We haven't exactly moved beyond stereotypes about women being crazy at that time of the month. These jokes are everywhere, even on pretty forward-thinking shows like Modern Family.
God, they're gonna ruin everything.
No. We just need to be extra sensitive.
Phil, honey, when do we need to leave?
Whatever's good for you, sweetie. Maybe 20 minutes?
12 hours!
Whenever you're ready.
But back in the 80s and 90s, it really was new and hard to make sense of. Not only was it totally out of left field to assert that a woman's period could be debilitating, but it had very problematic implications.
What would be the consequences if PMS were admitted as a legitimate defense in court, in your view? It's much more significantly a sword to be used against women than a shield for them.
This is Barbara Newman, one of the prosecuting attorneys in the Santos case.
No woman could ever be trusted with any position of responsibility, including having children, having the care and custody of children. This could justify assaults upon women. The man could say, this woman was out of control, I had to kill her, and there's the woman dead on the floor, not in a position to refute it.
The Santos case may have been the first in the U.S., but the other cases that got the public's attention made the diagnosis seem even more serious, like Sandy Smith in England, we mentioned earlier. She was charged with murder after she stabbed her coworker repeatedly, or Christine English, who ran down her lover with her car and pinned him after the affair went south. After the two violent cases in England, and now Santos, it looked like PMS as a defense was gathering steam.
I became interested because my branch chief at the time said, I have met an endocrinologist, and he claims that there are four women in his practice who attempted suicide during the luteal phase of their menstrual cycle.
This is Dr. David Rubino, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and founder of the Women's Mood Disorder Clinic there. Today he specializes in the most severe form of PMS. It has its own name, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, often just PMDD.
PMS or PMDD is triggered by changes in reproductive hormones, estrogen or progesterone. But that triggering occurs only in a subgroup of women, a group of women who are susceptible to hormone-induced mood changes. And we don't understand exactly what causes that susceptibility, but it is a biologically triggered syndrome. And we can demonstrate that. I can take someone who has PMS, PMDD, and I can eliminate her syndrome by stopping her ovarian steroid secretion, and PMDD will go away.
So this is kind of the evidence that this isn't just all in her head.
Exactly.
Well, it's not really a diagnosis. It's a social belief.
This is Dr. Nada Stotland. She's a psychiatrist in Chicago specializing in women's mental health and was president of the American Psychiatric Association from 2008 to 2009.
If we really believe that, are we going to screen every woman before she gets a responsible job? What about all the flight controllers and the pilots and the surgeons? Do you think 7% of female surgeons or 5% are disabled for several days a month? I don't believe it. And I do have an objection to having this diagnosis listed as a psychiatric diagnosis without any comparable investigation of the impact of male hormones on men.
Why?
Because women's hormones are used as an excuse to think that women are unstable. You know, we talked about at one point, you know, do you want a woman to have the red telephone in the president's office? That's a very dangerous and negative understanding of women and a denigration of their legitimate problems.
Back in the 80s in Brooklyn, the Santos case got more and more complicated. Shirley Santos totally undermined her own case when she told a TV reporter, it's not like I'm going to get my period so bad I start wailing on my child. It was a mess. It's still unclear whether she was pressured by the reporter or if she actually didn't believe her own defense. The lawyers made a deal. Santos pled guilty to a reduced charge, down from felony assault to a simple harassment violation, not even a misdemeanor, and she went home without her kids.
Why don't you think this has been part of the legal discourse since then?
You have to have a very special mixture. So you have a woman, and women don't commit that many crimes. A violent crime, women don't commit that many violent crimes.
I personally do not believe that PMS causes murder.
Again, Dr. David Rubino, head of UNC's Women's Mood Disorder Clinic.
I do think that someone who has antecedent behavioral problems may experience further compromise of their ability to regulate their behavior when they become increasingly symptomatic during the premenstrual state. But women with really severe PMDD do not kill people.
We talked to other scientists, just asked them, could it actually be this bad? They said yes. In some rare instances, PMDD could manifest itself so severely that a woman would be taken out of her ordinary mental state. And last year, the American Psychiatric Association put PMDD in their big book of mental disorders, the DSM-5. They classified it as a depressive disorder, saying the move was based on strong scientific evidence. So the science has evolved. What remains to be seen is whether or not public opinion has too.
Okay, before we go, I just want to get give us a round of applause if you think that PMS should be a valid legal defense. Do you believe it? Well, I guess that's who thinks it should not be a valid legal defense?
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Most people don't mingle with the rich and famous. Instead, we may watch celebrities strut the red carpet on TV. We see photos of their parties in magazines or get a glimpse of their personal lives with their kids or in parking lot paparazzi shots. We're not likely to sit across a dinner table from Matt Damon or laugh over drinks with Madonna. But if you're determined, quick thinking on your feet, and brazen enough to sneak past security guards, you may have a chance. Charlotte Laws was recently named one of the top 15 most notorious party crashers in the world. And she wrote for Gawker about some of her tactics and triumphs. Charlotte, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks.
So who knew there was a list of top party crashers?
I was surprised myself.
Well, how'd you get on the list?
I have no idea. I mean, I have done this my whole life, and I did write a book in the 1980s about how to meet your favorite celebrity. So I assume that that had something to do with the researcher finding me and deciding to make me number four on the list. And I was quite honored, I must say.
Who'd you beat out?
I beat out Bill Murray.
Whoa.
I beat out Queen Elizabeth was on the list. She was number 14.
One would think she'd be invited.
One would think so. Serena Williams and Lady Gaga got honorable mentions but did not make the list. So I was really quite honored.
Well, how did you get here? I mean, you grew up in Georgia. You say itself it's not the celebrity capital of the world. What prompted you to start crashing celebrity parties?
You know, I don't know. My friends, when I was a teenager, when I was 16, 17, my friends would, you know, hang out at parties, get drunk, do, you know, go bowling, do whatever teenagers would do. And I thought it would be a lot more fun to hang out with the president or celebrities and live the lifestyle of the rich and famous. So I figured the only way I was going to be able to achieve that was to actually crash, because I was not a VIP myself. I certainly didn't have the money to attend one of these events. And so I taught myself how to gate crash.
Well, okay, so that takes a lot of tenacity, a lot of drive. Have you come to figure out a way to prepare yourself, you know, kind of create a ritual before crashing a party?
No, I just kind of show up. I mean, there are times when I do something in advance to assure that I will probably get in. But most of the time, I just show up at an event and then I start thinking about various ways to penetrate security. And when I began doing it, I actually crashed an audition to land my first movie role. And then the one and only celebrity who I'd ever actually been interested in was Tom Jones. And I was able to meet him and not only land a date with him, but I dated him for 3 years.
Whoa.
And so from age 18 till 21, and I spent about a year attempting to get my first date with him. I put a lot of effort into making that happen, and then eventually it did. So
wow.
That was kind of a Cinderella story for me. And as I got older, I moved to Las Vegas and then to Los Angeles, and I realized there were a lot of benefits associated with party crashing. It wasn't just something to do with fun, but you could land interviews with well-known people for books or for articles. And then I realized that the benefits were getting celebrities signed on to causes or pushing for various legislation and meeting with the president or with senators or whoever might have some sort of impact in a particular form of legislation. So there were a lot of benefits to hobnobbing with the rich and famous.
Wow.
And, you know, you think about some of these fundraisers, which are $40,000 a person or $25,000 a person. the reason people go to these events is because they have that access. They're able to sit down with the president and talk about an issue that's important to them. And I wanted to have that access. So that's what I began to do as I got older.
Wow. So a lot there, a lot of strategy and a real lifestyle kind of choice for you, I guess. You do write in this article about meeting President Reagan a couple of different times, meeting Obama. And I'd love to hear about some of your tactics, like the one that's actually referred to in the title of the article for Gawker, which is called Emergency Delivery for George Clooney, My Life as an A-List Party Crasher. What what happened?
Well, yeah, this is the last time that I crashed Secret Service. I've actually crashed Secret Service four times. And this was a couple years ago. George Clooney had a fundraiser for President Obama at his house. And so I got there late by mistake, but I got there late, and they had the roads were blocked off around George Clooney's estate with Secret Service officers. And they kind of erred when they removed one of the barricades temporarily. And I just kind of went up the hill in my Nissan, and I was flagged down. And they said, you have to turn around and go back down the hill. And I had this bag that I had purchased from Rite Aid on my seat, and it actually had ponytail holders in it. But I said, oh, I have an emergency pharmaceutical delivery for a Mr. G. Clooney. And I pretended to be reading this little piece of paper, hoping that this Secret Service officer would believe me. And he looked around, not sure what to do. It looked like he was looking for someone else to advise him. And finally he said, I guess you can go up. So I went up to the house. There was nowhere to park because there were catering trucks and service vehicles everywhere. So I had to park in the driveway, which I felt really uncomfortable doing. But I got to go to the event. I got to meet the guests, and it was, you know, it was wonderful.
Well, you write about using the, you know, sometimes tears worked for you, being this kind of damsel in distress. Did you ever feel guilty using your sexuality for access?
Well, that was only one time, and that was the very first time. It was actually, I was 19 years old, and I didn't really intentionally use my tears to get in there. I was claustrophobic. The room was super crowded. This was at the in one of the inaugural balls when Reagan had just been elected into office. So I was at Reagan's inaugural ball, and he was on the other side of the ropes along with Jimmy Stewart and various other celebrities. And I didn't even know that I was going to get into the VIP area by crying. I was crying because I was so claustrophobic. I mean, the room was, it would take an hour or 45 minutes to get from one side to the other, and I couldn't move. And the Secret Service guards were standing right at this roped off area, and I just started crying. And they had pity on me and let me into this, you know, breezy, open VIP area, and I got to remain in that area for the rest of the evening. But in my mind, I wasn't trying to get over there. I was very happy that I did, and I was able to talk to the president, which was nice.
We're talking with Charlotte Laws. She was voted number 4 on the list of the world's 15 most notorious party crashers. Now, Charlotte, you just said that you have gotten through Secret Security 4 times. Should we be worried about that?
Well, no, they always check me for weapons. I mean, every single time I went into these events, I could not have gotten in with a knife or a gun. So I feel like Secret Service did their job. You know, their job is to protect the president from someone who wants to harm them. I did not have the means to harm anyone. So to me, they did their job. You know, all of these events, the president was protected, or the president-elect, or the, you know, whoever it might be that they were protecting. One event was John Kerry when he was running for president, and that was at Walt Disney Hall in Los Angeles, and that was really an amazing event, and that was a hard one to get through because I literally, on that particular occasion, I just kind of rushed through, and Secret Service was yelling at me, wait, we didn't see your ticket, come back here, and I just kind of kept going. And then once I got into the main hall, which was still filled with a lot of really interesting, you know, politicians and entertainment people, I was able to get backstage by latching myself onto an actress who I could tell was going backstage. And that's kind of one tactic you can use, is you kind of scope out, if you're in a theater or an auditorium, you scope out who you think is heading backstage, and then you very quickly become their friend. And you talk to them as they're walking past security, and security then thinks you're with them, and they let you into the backstage area. So I got into this green room, and that's where I, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio and Barbara Streisand, and I mean, everybody was there, Robert De Niro and John Kerry and you name it. And that was, it was really nice. I mean, I was very, felt very honored to have made it back there.
Well, I'm trying to imagine you know, you're at these $25,000 a plate fundraisers, or, you know, parties where people are, you know, there's expensive food, expensive cars, your Nissan parked outside some kind of way. And how does that look compared to your daily life, you know, and the people that you spend time with regularly?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of a homebody, so I don't really go out a lot other than to things here and there. I mean, I spend a lot of time at home. I'm very much into tennis. I have a court at my house, so that's kind of exciting for me. I have my animals. I have 9 chickens and 2 dogs, and we have people come over for dinner. But I'm not a person who actually likes to go to parties. That's what's kind of funny about this, is that I'm a party crasher, but I've never liked partying, really. I mean, I'm not a person who drinks alcohol. I've never had a glass in my life. So I have this kind of different lifestyle, in a sense, I guess you could say. But I definitely like spicing my life up from time to time, living in the bold zone, having these experiences that are unusual that I can remember and say, wow, that was cool how I was able to do X or Y, or accomplishing a goal because I was able to, you know, meet somebody who, you know, could help me accomplish whatever that goal was. So, yeah, I think it really can spice up somebody's life. And I think that you know, people should go after their dreams, you know, pursue whatever it is, whether it's something trivial or whether it's something important to them. You know, I encourage people to, you know, pursue that, to, as I said, live in the bold zone.
Well, Charlotte, thank you for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Charlotte Law, she's an L.A.-based writer, and she wrote about her experience as a longtime celebrity party crasher for Gawker. She's also author of a new memoir. It's called Rebel in High Heels. Now, there's a link to read her article, Emergency Delivery for G. Clooney, My Life as an A-List Party Crasher. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. So for Charlotte Law's, party crashing led to a career as a writer and a talk show host and an activist. Up next, we're going to hear about a very different kind of crasher in the news recently, whose story takes a much different turn. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard about a party crasher who regularly sneaked past the Secret Service and into celebrity parties, hobnobbing with A-listers and posing for photos with presidents. Our next story of gate crashing has none of that glitz or Hollywood glamour.
Yes, it is another arrest at a Chicago airport for the so-called serial stowaway.
After being arrested in Los Angeles, she was sentenced to 2 years probation and 3 days in jail.
The judge has ordered a psychiatric evaluation for a woman with a history of trying to sneak onto airplanes after she
63-year-old Mariel Hartman has been apprehended dozens of times at airports across the country, but has still made it past security and onto planes without a ticket. Her repeated stints in jail have turned her into the serial stowaway, subject of a Kickstarter campaign, a kind of folk hero to some, and low-hanging fruit for TV news. Despite the number of sound bites and headlines devoted to her, little has been done to understand what's behind her compulsive attempts to take flight. Joe Eskenazi is senior editor at San Francisco Magazine, and he wrote an extensive article about Marilyn Hartman. Well, Joe, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So you spoke to Marilyn over the course of a few months. Well, first, I'm curious what she told you about how she's been able to make it through security checkpoints.
You know, she's talked to me about that. She's talked to a few people about that. And in all of the police and incident reports, they do go over that. And it's not very high tech. Sometimes it's as simple as waiting for the TSA agent to be distracted and walking past him, or ducking under a gate, or waving what appears to be a boarding pass but is actually a bus timetable, or pretending that you're someone when you're not, when a leading question is asked by a gate agent, such as, are you Philip Alum or something like that? And you just say yes. So it's not super difficult, and she has a very high failure rate. So if you're willing to go 1 for 15 or 1 for 20, you can do this.
Well, the TSA has circulated photographs of her. She's banned from several airports. She's sometimes apprehended, sometimes jailed, sometimes not. But you dug into her motivation. What is she trying to do? Why does she just keep setting herself up for this failure?
I talked to her about this, and it wasn't very illuminating. She told me that she has whistleblower trauma syndrome, and she described a long and somewhat difficult to parse 20-year persecution coming from up on high. She said President Obama has been complicit in this for decades, and as a result, she feels like getting on a plane and flying away. She just has to get out of it. As you may have noted, it's not a happy tale. When you look at the incident reports, she often admits to the officers, you know, I'm so depressed, I just needed to get out of here. And I just needed to get off the island and when she was arrested in Hawaii, or I don't know what to do, I just have to leave. And sometimes she'll even have said, I tried to make myself stop coming to the airport, but I couldn't do it.
Persecution from on high, compulsive behavior, the FBI is involved, sounds like hallmarks of mental illness.
Oh, there's definitely mental illness. Even she will admit that she's mentally ill. Looking through, again, extensive records, she's taking a number of medications for, I believe, PTSD and depression. But PTSD and depression are not conditions that readily explain compulsive airport behavior like this. And I talked to a psychologist and a psychiatrist, and he said this was a very difficult diagnosis. I'm confident that the extensive analyses done in jailhouses across the country may have touched on some of this. But the most recent analysis in Chicago, where she's currently incarcerated, said that she was sane at the time that she was arrested multiple times and is sane with medication. So it's something that it's not easily diagnosed and it's certainly not easily treated.
Any clues looking into her history or family members that could help offer an explanation?
There just is no origin story like with a superhero. She wasn't struck by lightning while watching a plane take off and thereby being, you know, compelled to go to airports. It's very hard to put a finger on why this compulsive behavior takes place. Going over her family history as much as we could, and I spoke to two men that she claimed are her brothers, have the same family last name, and talked about family history, but clammed up when I said, are you her brother? So take from that what you will. They just said that she's not been really a part of their lives. One of them lashed out and said that she was manipulative and could get whatever she wanted and could work the system. And she graduated from high school. She took courses in, I believe, in business college and claims to be a legal secretary. Mm-hmm. You can start seeing an odyssey of traveling around the country starting about 15 years ago or so, and homelessness more recently than that.
Well, pretty obvious from news reports and the things that you uncover in your article that she really does need help, which she doesn't seem to be getting. She's still getting a lot of attention, but is she getting help?
Not really. This is something I went into in the article, that even a couple of decades ago, within our lifetimes, you could get people committed to mental institutions against their will relatively easily. And the pendulum on that has swung very much the other way, that someone like Marilyn Hartman, who is obviously doing things that are socially unacceptable and seems compelled to do them by forces that she cannot control, however, is also mentally aware and cognizant enough to say, I don't want to be incarcerated and I don't want to be in these programs. And the way the laws are now, as long as you're not a harm to others and to yourself, you can pretty much keep doing these things, and The legal system does not really have a place for the mentally ill like this. It seems that in Marilyn Hartman's future is incarceration and more of it. But it doesn't seem to be any kind of treatment. Here in the Bay Area, in San Mateo County, which is just one over from San Francisco and actually where the airport is here, they took pity on her and they compassionately tried to put her into an outpatient treatment home. And she just walked out of it. You know, she didn't want to be there. Mm-hmm. She wanted to do what she wanted to do. And and that doesn't seem to fit with what the rest of society expects.
She does seem to have an exaggerated, I guess, fight or flight reaction. You know, just, I got to get out of here kind of thing.
Yeah, this came up. She's, you know, when you talk to Marilyn, she's able to tell jokes and be funny. And when I said, and she said, I have a fight or flight reference. And I said, you literally have a fight or flight reference. And she, and you know, it was a point of humor. So, and yet she still keeps doing this compulsively. And in the most recent incident, it seems more disturbing than those in the past. She actually had a ticket to fly from Chicago to LaGuardia, and she flies with tickets, I believe, all the time. That's how she gets around the country. But created a disturbance on the plane, you know, saying unusual things like they're starting a war and I want a helmet, and was arrested. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit out of the MO, is to behave like that on a plane.
Well, you know, this began as a, I don't know, a story that in the age of terrorism that a woman could talk herself onto planes over all over the country started sounding to me terribly, terribly sad, which I think is where you came to. When did that turn for you?
Well, the first couple of times when you don't actually watch interactions with this person and don't realize that her history goes back further than people thought. You know, she became an internet phenomenon for what happened here in San Francisco last year, but this disturbing behavior of trying to talk her way into airplanes and being arrested at airports goes back to the earliest that I could find is 2009. Half a dozen or more security experts I talked to pointed out that this really isn't a security problem. It's a procedure problem. She was checked for contraband. It's just that she managed to walk on without a ticket. The sadness of it, you know, it became clear that this is someone who was locked in a routine that there doesn't seem to be an exit from. And to me, that, you know, that the second or third arrest, that became very clear. There's no compulsory mental health program. It seems inhumane to jail a senior citizen like this. So it just became a repetitive thing. And then she left the Bay Area and started doing it again and again and again elsewhere. And as long as she doesn't want to stop, she will not stop.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for your investigation on this and for speaking with us today.
Oh, it's the least I can do. Thank you so much. And I hope this ends better than it appears to be ending.
Joe Eskenazi, senior editor at San Francisco Magazine. That's where we found his article, The Woman Who Smuggled Herself Inside the Endless Gate-Crashing Saga of Serial Stowaway Marilyn Hartman. There's a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. While Marilyn Hartman's compulsion to fly is rooted in a complex mental illness and a need for escape, for others, taking to the skies is a joy. Dorothy Hayes sat down with her son Keyes at StoryCorps to tell him the story of how she became a flight attendant in the 1940s.
How does a young girl get a job with Delta Airlines in 1945?
My uncle, he said, well, what would you really like to do, Doc? And I said, I think I'd like to work for the airlines. He said, have you applied anywhere? And I said, yes, an American. And he said, would you be interested in working for Delta? And I said, I don't know anything about Delta. And he said, it will become one of the best airlines in the world. Go home and write for an application. I did. And they sent me an application, and I filled it out and mailed it back. And I had a special delivery from them wanting to know if I could come for an interview.
Did they have appearance standards?
Yeah. You had to have short hair, for one thing, and you had to be well-groomed. In fact, Mr. Sutton used to check the stockings to be sure your seams were straight.
That must have been an interesting job.
Yeah, he was very nice. The first flight I had was an early morning flight. This friend of mine said, go up in the cockpit and see the takeoff. And I did, and it was the most beautiful thing in the world to see the sun rising. I loved it. I knew then I had the right job. I still, every time a plane goes over, I think, oh, I wish I was on it going somewhere.
Why did you leave? Why did you stop flying?
To get married. Then you couldn't be married and fly. Hadn't thought much about being a housewife and a mother, to tell you the truth. And I wouldn't take $1 million for any of you. I wouldn't give you a nickel for another one, but for all four of you, I sure am proud of all of you.
And that's Dorothy Hayes with her son Keyes at StoryCorps in Jackson, Mississippi. Their conversation will be archived, along with all StoryCorps interviews, at the Library of Congress. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including the Word of Mouth podcast. You can sign up for it there or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, write a review and pass it on. Tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.